All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. So today we're going to speak about the Kabbalah of the nose, or the Kabbalah of the nostrils. Okay, so let's back it up for a minute. It's interesting that when we talk about the creation of the first human being, Adam and Eve, the Torah says originally male and female he created them, so they were created as one unified being. They were then divided, Adam and Eve were, into two, and then they were able to come together in a way that was face-to-face as opposed to where they were fused back-to-back. But the way the Torah describes creation is that God created Adam from the earth, and then, the Torah famously says, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. So God breathed into Adam's nostrils the breath of life. Sure.
I thought it said he breathed into Adam. I didn't know that it specifically.
Yes, nostrils. Yeah, vayipach ba'apav. He blew into his nostrils nishmat chayim. Not even a breath of life. Actually, it's a soul of life, a living soul. Nishmat, like a neshama. Nishmat chayim, a soul of chayim, of life. So, the Kabbalists. Everyone deals with this question: why the nose? What's with the nose? Why not in the ear? Or why not in his mouth? I mean, if you think of breathing, right? Think of breathing. God, vayipach, is not only breathed into his nostrils, it's kind of he blew into his nostrils. Like if you would take your mouth and you would blow forcefully a breath of air out, right? So that's how, so to speak, how God is described as blowing into Adam this living soul. So if it's emanating, God doesn't have a body and God doesn't have a mouth. But if it's emanating, if the terminology that's used is God is blowing into Adam the soul of life, then why isn't it almost mouth to mouth? Why isn't it that God blew into Adam's mouth this breath of life? Why into the nose specifically? So it's interesting. The Kabbalists say that the Kabbalists say that of all of the five senses, the sense of smell is the most spiritual. That's what it says. Of all the five senses, the sense of smell is the most spiritual. So we have touch, we have sight. So there's touch, sight, taste, hearing, and then smell, right? And scent. So of the five senses, smell is the most refined and the most associated with spirituality. So touch, very tangible. When you touch something, it's very physical. You can't touch something spiritual. I mean, you can't touch an idea. You can't touch an emotion. We might use those terminologies. Like I didn't grasp what you were saying, but we don't mean it literally grasp. You can't grasp an idea literally with your hands. So touch, physical touch, is very physical. It's not so spiritual. Seeing, okay. Sight is associated with light. You can't see without light, and light, of course, is spiritual. But nonetheless, sight is looking at something, again, that is physical, and it's beholding the physical characteristics of something, so sight also is associated with physicality. Hearing as well. Hearing is perhaps a little bit more ethereal. In other words, it's not necessarily that you're beholding the physical parameters of something. You're hearing something, so it's a little bit more. Maybe one could say it's a little bit more spiritual. Nonetheless, it still has a tangible quality to it. Taste, of course, typically we're eating food, and food is, of course, something that is very tangible, physical, materialistic, and, of course, can draw a person down into materialism. Food is one of the big challenges that people have as far as being centered and eating in a mindful and unhealthy fashion. But it's smell that the Kabbalists say, smell, the sense of smell, is that which is most associated with spirituality and godliness, which is why, one of the reasons why, in the Saturday night prayers, after the end of Shabbat, so it's called the Havdalah prayer, in which we officially close out the Shabbat and usher in a new work week. So there are a few blessings that are recited. We say a blessing over the wine, and we drink it, so that's taste. We say a blessing over the fire. We hold a candle interwoven of several wicks. We say a blessing over fire, and we behold the flame, the fire. And we take spices. Some use cloves, some use cinnamon. You say a blessing over the cinnamon, over the spice, and you breathe in the you breathe in those sweet scents. Now this is associated with, and it's a very ancient Jewish custom to do this. It's associated with the fact that we're leaving the Sabbath, we're leaving Shabbat, which is a day of spirituality, and we're going into the dark work week. So we have our torch. Right, we have a flame to guide us into the dark week ahead, and we need a little l'chaim, maybe we need a little glass of wine to get us through all this. I say that tongue in cheek, obviously, but wine, it says, gladdens the heart. Wine or grape juice, whatever, it gladdens the heart. And then the final item is are the spices, and that's kind of like the smelling salts, if you will. I know smelling salts are different, but it's this invigoration, the scent of invigoration that can give us positivity entering the week. But it's the smelling of the spices associated with giving the nose a sense of pleasure. It's that the Kabbalists speak about the specific power and the specific intensity of that blessing and of that experience in the Saturday night ritual. So although there are blessings over three different senses, sense of taste, the sense of taste of the wine, sight of the flame, and scent of the nose, but the scent is specifically associated with the soul. Scent is associated with this idea that on Shabbat we have an extra soul. It says there's a neshama yitera, an extra soul that comes into a person on Shabbat. After Shabbat, that extra soul leaves. And so to reinvigorate ourselves, we introduce something sweet, a sweet smell into the nose. And that can pick up our spirits as we enter the dark week ahead, or the challenging week ahead, the mundane week ahead. There's a story told about the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad. That one time, one of his chassidim, one of his disciples, gave him a gift. And he gave him a silver box. It was a snuff box. You know what a snuff box is? Mm-hmm. I think today, I don't know how many people use snuff. Snuff is kind of like is it tobacco?
It's tobacco.
It's tobacco. People, so they're smoking tobacco, but there's also smelling tobacco. So people would take a pinch, right? A pinch of tobacco and smell it, but it's strong tobacco, no? It's like a strong, it gives you a real, I'll tell you where it's also used. Huh? It gives you a buzz. So some use it on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, so you're not eating or drinking, so you might get a little faint. You might get a little bit weak. So I remember growing up in the synagogue in Pittsburgh that I went to, the old timers used to have, you know, a little bag or a little pouch or a little something, a little box, and you would pass it around. You know, like, smell this, it'll get you, it'll keep you going, it'll give you a kick in the middle of the day as the day where 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, the fast is over, what, 6, 7 o'clock at night. You're hitting the midday, like, you know, kind of that rough patch. It's like, smell some of this, it'll wake you up. You also see athletes sometimes, football players, you know, baseball players. You'll see them smell hockey players. You see them smell these smelling spices, whatever it's called. Yeah, and it kind of invigorates them. So a person, a disciple of the Alter Rebbe, once gave him a silver, pure silver snuff box. No, that's what people use. They smelled it, and you put it. You have to have a box, and it became a thing, a fancy display box. So someone gave it to him as a gift. Of course, he said thank you, but later on, he remarked, "The nose is the only part of the body that we don't run after trying to fulfill its desires." To explain. We run after things that we see. We like to see things. We like to hear gossip. We like to taste things. We like to touch things. Smell is probably I said before, it's the most spiritual. It's also the less materialistic in the sense that we don't necessarily run after scent. It's like, oh my gosh, I need to smell something. It's like, oh, I need to eat something. I need to hear. I can't wait to hear that piece of news or gossip, God forbid, right? Or I want to look at something, or I want to touch something. But smell, we're typically not running after. So the Alter Rebbe said, we're not running after to fulfill the desire of smell. Not that we don't enjoy, you know, smells, whatever, but it's not something that we need a fix, we need a hit. Like, okay, I need to smell something. It's not typically a thing. So the Alter Rebbe remarked, smell is the only thing, you know, it's the one out of five senses that we don't typically indulge in. And this person now wants me to indulge in this also. In other words, he was remarking, this fellow, with good intentions, gave him a snuff box. But what's a snuff box? It's to feed the nose. Ay, the nose is the last remaining pure sense of all five senses. It's the only one that's remaining that many of us don't run after and indulge. And this person, this fellow, is giving me something to tempt my nose also. So he said, I'm not going to use it as a snuff box. What he did was, he took off, it was a silver box, beautiful silver box. He took off the top, and he used the top as a mirror to check his tefillin, the boxes that he wore on his head every morning to make sure he's supposed to wear them centered between the eyes. It says in Deuteronomy, in the Shema, in the prayer that we say is the Shema, it's on the mezuzah scroll on the doorpost, and it's inside the tefillin boxes also. It says, you shall place them as a sign between your eyes and over your heart. So we put one box on the arm, right opposite the heart, left side, right opposite the heart, and we put the head, there's a second box that we put on top of the head, right? Second box on top of the head. It's centered, we don't put it literally between the eyes, it'd be awkward. We put it on top of the head, centering it between the eyes. So he used the top of the snuff box as a mirror to be able to check, to make sure it's centered. You know, it might be a little here, a little there. So he used it as a mirror. Now you can use your selfie camera on your phone. Technology is amazing. You don't need a key. You don't even need a mirror, right? Now you just use a selfie camera and you just check it out and you make sure that you're centered. But that didn't exist. The Alter Rebbe was born in 1745 and he passed away in 1812. So this was late 1700s, I'm sure. Maybe early 1800s. So they didn't have, obviously, selfie cameras to check. By the way, you should know that his grandson, when someone told his grandson, or maybe great-grandson, I think his grandson, the story of the Alter Rebbe, his grandfather, breaking the box and using the top for a mitzvah, for tefillin, and not using the snuff box, that he's like, I don't want to be tempted in the nose. Like, maybe on Yom Kippur, I don't know if Yom Kippur he smelled it like other people in the congregation. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he didn't need it. But he said, don't tempt my nose now. Leave the nose alone. And we'll see how, again, we'll get back to the soul and the connection between the nose and the soul. And we'll get back there in a second. But one thing, just parenthetically, when somebody told this story to the Tzemach Tzedek, good morning. So the Tzemach Tzedek remarked, that story didn't happen the way it appears. My grandfather definitely did not break the top of the box, the top of that silver snuff box, to use it as a mirror. So what happened? So the hinge had a pin. He took out the pin. He was able to remove the pin, and that way what's the difference? He said, my grandfather wouldn't break anything. He's not going to break something, right? He's not wasn't a destructive person to damage something and break something because he didn't like the way it looked or whatever. But to remove a pin, that he would do. To remove a pin, to now separate it. But it's a message in life also. There's two ways to go about it. Sometimes you can go about it with force and break it, whatever it is. Or you can remove a pin, do it in a more gentle fashion and keep things intact. That's again, a parenthetical message. What we see here is that, again, the nose. Sure.
To me, when he said my grandfather would not break something,
sure.
To me that says that he would not get angry. too.
Certainly, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. He wouldn't get angry and wouldn't be filled with a sense of destructiveness. Like, I need to break it.
Well, that's also saying that the anger is very destructive.
Yes, 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 yes. And it also harkens back to an age-old Hasidic teaching of the Baal Shem Tov, the Alter Rebbe's spiritual grandfather. Well, not his literal grandfather, but two generations of Hasidic masters above the Alter Rebbe was the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov, then the Maggid of Mizrich, and then the Alter Rebbe. So it's his spiritual grandfather. He used to call him Zayde, grandfather.
Can I ask one more thing about him?
Sure, sure, sure.
Because I had a discussion with someone about this. Said God didn't. Well, I guess he said there's a place for anger inside of some verses of the Torah where God got angry as justification for anger.
Yeah.
And how do you rationalize, occasionally the reference that God would get angry?
It's a
with the idea that one should never,
yes,
never get angry. That is the.
Yeah. So, number one, what you're saying regarding anger is correct. And Maimonides famously writes that although one should typically find the median of all character traits and be kind of in the middle, don't be an extremist either way. He says when it comes to anger, be an extremist the other way, not on the side of anger. Don't be in the middle. Sometimes I get angry, sometimes I don't get angry, or I get angry for the right reasons. He says stay away from anger because it's by nature it's destructive for oneself and for the other. So you're right. Even righteous anger, you can right a wrong without being angry about it. You can be horrified even about something that's happening and be driven to fix it and to right the wrong and to root out whatever it is, but you don't have to be filled at that very same time with this emotion of anger. Anger doesn't help. Anger causes a person to lose one's mind. And I don't say that figuratively. I guess I do kind of say that figuratively. But the Torah gives example. The Torah cites a few times where it says that, the Torah references a few times that Moses gets angry. And all three times, it's followed by him forgetting something. Yeah, him forgetting something. And the Talmud says, when somebody gets angry, it causes them to forget. Moshe forgets laws, halachot, when he gets angry. Even Moses, the great Moses, it negatively affected him. And the Kabbalists talk about this at length, about the negativity of anger. Maimonides, the philosopher and the great rabbi and sage and scholar, and the halachist, talks about the negative thing about anger. So your question is, how do you reconcile that with God getting angry? So there's two points that I can say about that. Number one, even if, I'm going to address this in a second. God gets angry. Who says God said that we should get angry? Right? God never said, get angry like I get angry. I don't remember a verse saying that. Even if you want to say that God got angry, who's to say that you have to emulate God? Are we doing such a good job emulating all of God's other teachings and character traits that we also need to emulate this? Or are we using that as an excuse to fall back on our own, maybe not so perfect behavior? That's number one. Yeah. Well, that's my second point. And the second point is, who says God gets angry? So you have a verse where it sounds like God is getting angry. And Maimonides famously writes, also Maimonides, he writes that God does not possess human emotions. And anytime you find an emotion mentioned in Scripture, God's love, God's anger, God's retribution, God's jealousy, he says, it's not meant to be taken literally at all. What it is for us, it's speaking in our language. And what that means is like this. If you and I encounter a certain situation, and we respond to that situation in a certain way, the assumption is that it's going to be driven by a certain emotion. Like if you see, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a good example. If somebody is hurting someone else and you take them and you take the assailant, the one that hurt the other person, and you you know, there are consequences and you punish them, whatever. So typically, we're going to say that it was associated with anger or retribution or some sort of, you know, justice. Whatever. We would put an emotional layer associated with the action. It's not just dispassionate action in resulting from the first action. Somebody did something, and so totally dispassionately, you know, we did this, and that was the second action. It's typically associated with an emotion. So Maimonides says that when it comes to God, God doesn't have the emotion, even though God takes the action, but Torah will use the emotion that human beings would typically have. So, if the Jewish people, for example, are kvetching again, they're in the desert, and God's taking miraculous care of the Jewish people, feeding them, protecting them, guiding them on their way, right? Their clothing grew with them and was magically cleaned. You know, talk about the original dry cleaning, like whatever, right? Everything was amazing. The food fell down every day, every morning. The enemies, you know, were scared before them, and all the mountains and the snakes and scorpions, the path was paved before them. It was all smooth sailing. Everything was amazing. And still they complained. And so they were punished. So the Torah will say that God got angry and punished them. Maimonides says God didn't actually get angry. God doesn't have any emotion of anger. It's just that there are consequences. Why are there consequences? So again, certain consequences are embedded in the laws of the universe. That when something is done, another result has to happen, even for the benefit of that person that did it. Sometimes you need a consequence to redirect your behavior. So it could be from love. But the point is that the Torah, Maimonides says, the Torah uses language like anger, jealousy, even love that we can associate with. But not necessarily does God actually get angry. So that's why I said, even if we say that God got angry, who's to say that we also need to get angry? There's not a mitzvah, the 613 mitzvah, that says you have to get angry. Number one, even the laws of justice, you know, the Torah doesn't say that a judge has to be angry about someone that does something wrong, just has to execute judgment and serve justice, but not get angry about it, right? So this whole anger, good morning, this whole anger idea is really, I would say, I don't know what the right word is. It's misplaced, and it doesn't have its source. And again, that's even if you want to say that God actually got angry, which according to classic Jewish sources, God doesn't get angry. God's not like, it's like, oh man, you stepped on my shoe, I'm upset. It's not a thing. It's like,
what's fascinating is, you know, we've sort of evolved to the point where we recognize that the anthropomorphic attributes which are attributed to God are not to be taken literally.
Exactly.
But it's much harder to extend that to the emotional aspects. You know, we
right.
We can say, of course God doesn't have an arm.
But he gets angry, and he'll use his force to hit. Right, exactly.
It's another step.
Yes.
To recognize.
So, exactly. And thanks for articulating it that way. And Maimonides says that not only does God not have a body, but any type of bodily descriptions, right, which include the emotions, God does not have. It doesn't mean we're not limiting God by saying he doesn't have something, but God is not limited to the experience of emotion the way we have it. It's not like God actually gets jealous, right? Don't serve other gods because I'm going to get jealous. Really? God is like this. First of all, you know, if you're getting jealous of something else, it means you're not so secure in who you are, right? Like, you care that Yankel is going ahead and following something that's not true? Like, that gets you upset? It's like, no, everyone has to know me and serve me. So it's not only emotion, it's really petty emotion. It's very petty. That cannot be God. The question is, how do you explain all those verses? And that's a valid question. And that's, you know, Jewish philosophy explains it. Kabbalah explains it. But the premise has to be, we can't make God this really small, petty, human, projected God. Because what kind of God? That's what we're serving. That's what we're focusing on. That's what we're running at. I mean, that's what we're involved in. It's serving a God that's so petty and so low.
Come on. I actually said this, though. I have difficulty not sort of accepting that God doesn't have love. that's an emotion.
Right, right. So I mentioned love, right. I mentioned love as one of the things that we can't say that God has. Look, you know, it's an involved discussion. Because Kabbalah says that God is beyond any of the spherot. He projects the spherot, which have the emotional qualities, but God is beyond that. But in his essence, we're there also. We are there also. So we stem from God's essence. The soul comes from God's essence, which means that there is a love, but maybe it's beyond the emotion of love. Maybe it's a oneness. Yeah, it just is beyond love. So we would express it as, well, you love that which is one with you, right? You love yourself. You love your family. You love those that are like you, right? So we associate that with love. Perhaps we could say that it's even deeper than that. It's just, there's a connection. And that's not an emotion, that's just reality. There's a connection that's deep-seated. And that, in human terms, equals love. The way we can look at God also. You know, we discussed that the recent Kabbalah, the recent JLI Kabbalah course, that there are two ways to look at God. There's the way that God looks at God from the top down, and the way God looks at us from the top down. And then there's the way that we look at God from the bottom up. We look at God, and we're going to anthropomorphize him. Like, we can't not. Because we know ourselves. So we know love, and we know anger, and we know jealousy, and we know revenge. We know this. So when we look at God, we take this and go up. No matter how far you go up, you're still taking your stuff with you. You still take your experience and your reality and your personality. You take that with you as you approach God. So it's really hard to strip ourselves from those patterns of thinking and feeling and comprehension and conception. It's really difficult to do that. If we would look at reality from the top down, if and we can't really, right? If we could look at reality from God's perspective, things would be completely different. God wouldn't have the emotions, and God wouldn't have. So that's what we have to be. You can tell. I don't know who you're speaking with, but again, I think the basic point is, you're right. God seems to be pretty angry. Maybe it's a lesson that we shouldn't. I'm saying you could say such a thing, and it may be a little blasphemous in truth, but you can kind of like diffuse it with maybe a little bit of humor, saying, yeah, God seems like he needs, maybe he needs a little bit of, he needs to talk it through first, but that doesn't mean that it's a message for us to be angry, number one. Number two, God doesn't get angry. And even when there's punishing the Egyptians and the Jewish people, we see it as consequences. I'll tell you what the Rebbe once said. You guys know Jerry Farber, the comedian? Do you know his brother? Jerry Farber's brother? He has a brother, and I'm forgetting his first name. His brother's name is... He has a radio show. I don't know if he's still on the radio. He had it for decades in New York City. Lives in New York. And he once... So Jerry, of course, is Jewish. His brother's Jewish. And but he wouldn't describe himself as a religious Jew. Jerry's brother, the radio host. Danielle, you
yeah. Yeah, me too.
Okay. All right, you guys are on it. Let me know when you pull up his name. His name is not Ron. It's not Ronald Farber. It's
Barry.
I was just thinking David. Yeah, Barry Farber. Good. So Barry Farber once had a rabbi, a Chabad rabbi, I think it was Rabbi Posner from Nashville, Tennessee, Rabbi Zalman Posner, I think it might have been him. He had him on his radio show interviewing him. This is decades ago, like in the 60s, I want to say. And he asked him, what's the story that, you know, the Torah says that you have to keep the Sabbath, and if you don't, then there are consequences, even to the point, potentially of capital punishment with Shabbat. That seems very archaic and very, like, what's up with that? So the rabbi says, you know, it's not, the Jewish courts, even back in the day, well, you don't have a Jewish court today, even back in the day, it was very rare that that would happen, and people weren't executed because you would need warnings, and it wouldn't really happen. He danced around the topic. He's like, it wouldn't really happen anyway. So the Rebbe found out about this interview. And at the next Fabrengen, on Shabbat, he spoke about it. And he said, it was a nice answer, but it was a very apologetic answer. Because the bottom line is, what if there was the warning, and what if there were the witnesses, and what if there was a court? Could it get to that place? Yes. How? It doesn't make sense. For just, you know, violating Shabbat, such a big thing? Like, what? Don't tell me it probably didn't happen. What if it did? How does that make sense? Right? You can't dance around the question. It's a good question. So here's how the Rebbe phrased it. And it's not about Shabbat, but it's. I mean, maybe it was for that conversation. But I want to say it's about consequence, if you will, in a sense. The Rebbe referenced the space, you know, the 60s was a time of space exploration, from what I hear, right? So space exploration. So the Rebbe referenced NASA. And he said, how much money is put into a space shuttle launch? How much money? I mean, today it's probably billions. It's got to be billions, right? Back then, millions. Hundreds of millions, I would imagine. And there's so... It's not only the rockets and the technology and all that stuff. It's also the astronauts and the training and the suits and all of the training they go through. It's a huge thing. You don't just launch. I mean, today, you know, what's his name? Elon Musk, he's launching things right and left, and that guy is wild. You know, he's digging under Chicago. Did you see that? He just got a contract for Chicago.
Yeah.
You see that?
$100 billion.
He's going to come in right under is it 100 billion or 1 billion? I don't remember.
I heard 100.
Is it 100?
Does that on his spare time.
The guy, listen to this. This is now a side point. He just like has ideas and tweets them and then makes them. He just released a flamethrower. Did you see this last week? Okay. So he said one day, he just tweeted out one day, like, oh, I think I'm going to make a flamethrower. And everyone's like, whatever. And then he's like, yeah. And then the government came out, or customs said, well, no, you can't like do flamethrower. You can't call something a flamethrower. So he called it now not a flamethrower. So it's literally called not a flame. It's a flamethrower. He calls it not a flamethrower, and he took pre-orders and they just shipped them, and it's ridiculous. But he created this thing. The company that he has to dig the tunnels. You know what it's called?
Boring.
The Boring Company. Called BORING. The Boring Company. He's hilarious. What did he announce today? He just announced something today. He announced that he's going to put on his new supercar. He's going to put rocket boosters on it. And the internet is now exploding because of that. Oh, it's not going to be safe or whatever it is.
My apologies. It says the craziest thing about Elon Musk's express loop is the price, $1 billion.
Oh, $1 billion. Yeah. Yeah. So he was going to come, he said he's going to come in under $1 billion. And the experts are saying it's not possible because the new New York subway line that they were building or that they just released, or what they just opened, cost something like $10 million per mile, and this is going to be like, whatever it is, the math doesn't necessarily line up. Whatever, he'll take a loss on it, he probably doesn't care. The point is, getting back to the space shuttle. Yeah, so he launches them, and you know, him and Bezos, the Amazon guy, I think, right? I think they're all just launching rockets and landing them back, and it's fun for them, which is fine, which is great. But the Rebbe spoke about this in the 1960s, and he said that there's a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of investment that goes in. He says, imagine if you're the astronaut and you're on this mission and you're in outer space, or you're on the rocket and you're taking off and you're in the process of breaking through the atmosphere. You are highly trained and you need to follow a protocol. And if you break the protocol, it's not just, don't bother him, he's a free person, you know, he's allowed to do what he wants. Like, who am I to get involved in individuals' actions? Like, we're all about autonomy, right? United States, everyone should do what they want to do. But no, not if you're an astronaut on a mission. If you're an astronaut on a mission, you can't just do what you want to do. It's not safe. It's not safe to you. It's not safe to the other astronauts with you. It's not safe to the rocket. It's not safe to the government. It's not safe to the planet. It can't just. And if you make one small wrong move, I remember seeing the Challenger in 1980. Was it 87, 86? Right around there?
Yeah.
I remember seeing the other one with the Israeli guy. Remember that? In the late 90s. He took a Torah. Yeah? Remember this one in Florida? Yeah. I guess they're all from Florida. But he was a first Israeli, Ilan Ramon, I think was his name. He first Israeli astronaut. He took a Torah, I think from the Holocaust, a small Torah that had escaped or whatever it was. That had come out from after the Holocaust, and exploded, tragically. The Rebbe said that one small move could endanger an entire mission and literally be suicidal, and not only suicidal for the person, but also homicidal, if you will, for everyone else. The Rebbe said the Torah is teaching us how important Shabbat is or other things are. It's not just this or that. It's very important. What's the overall point, though? I'm now forgetting how we got into this. The point is, no, I do remember this, is that when we read in Torah about God's punishment, right, the Jews were kvetching, so a bunch of them died, lost their lives, you could say that God got angry and punished, or you can say that there are consequences. You know, there are consequences, and on a very basic level, by unplugging themselves from their source of life, so they literally lost their lives. They lost their lives because they unplugged from the source. So the idea, the notion of anger being something that's kosher is really not not a true and valid approach within classic Jewish thought. So the Alter Rebbe, when he was given this gift of the snuff box, which he said was now going to tempt his nose, and he didn't want to have any part of it. He's like, the nose is the last thing that's still pure. I need to now set myself up for temptation. Not happening. He didn't break the box. He pulled out the pin from the hinge and used the top part as a mirror for his tefillin. So what we see from this is, again, that the nose is the last haven of spirituality, or might be the last haven of spirituality in an otherwise materialized body. The body is materialistic. It's almost like the nose is that last place that's still a little bit pure, still untainted, if you will. And it's the first place where the breath of life, where the soul of life enters. So you have the soul. God breathes in to the human being, the soul, through the nose. It goes into the nose and then fills the person. But the nose remains, in a sense, holy. Literally and figuratively, right? The nose remains. I saw that coming. The nose remains, in a sense, spiritual and unblemished, grabbed, it's not grabbed by materialism. We run after our eyes, we run after our taste, we run after touch, we run after hearing, smell, we enjoy it, but it's the most refined of the senses. Now, so that's a little bit about the nose. Kabbalah teaches that every morning we have this experience, this re-experience of the soul entering into our nose, and then from the nose going into the rest of the body. I mean, think about this. The word for soul in Hebrew is neshama. The word for breath, taking a breath with the nose in Hebrew, is called neshima. You hear the similarity? Neshama and neshima. Neshima means breath. I guess you could take a breath with your mouth, but it typically means a breath with your nose. Inhale with your nose. Neshima, Neshama, neshima. It's the same. It's basically the same word. It's just a little bit of a vowel here or there, right? So the soul is associated with the breath. It's not surprising that in many systems of spiritual meditation or centering or what, there's the idea of breath plays a very important role, right? If you want to get calm, if you want to get centered, if you want to get in touch with your with yourself, so there's a method of mindful breathing where you're aware of the breath that you're taking. Typically, you're breathing in with your nose and breathing out with your mouth, which is very similar to the process of creation. Think about it. God breathes out. God doesn't have a mouth, right? And God's not actually breathing out. But the way it's described, right? God is blowing out with his mouth. There's the exhale. And then that soul spirit of life goes into Adam's nostrils. Seemingly, he would be breathing that in. And so there you have that cycle of breath. In through the nose, out through the mouth. And we find today that that's a very big deal. It's a very big, and people are doing it, and it's very helpful to be mindful breathing, to be aware of breath, to block out all distractions and just be present with your breath in and out. And Kabbalah will teach that this is really emblematic. It mirrors, if you will, the process of creation, and specifically human creation, where God is breathing out and God is blowing out and Adam is breathing in. And there you have that cycle of breath, of life, in and out, where really that's that cycle of life, where life is to be found. Now, being that the nose is so holy and spiritual and so associated with life, Kabbalah teaches that, again, that's where the soul begins and that's where it can be found. But here's the point, that it's our job to move the spirit from the nose into the rest of the body. So our job is to take the soul that is already in the nose and bring it into the rest of the body so that the rest of the body is as spiritual as the nose is inherently. So the nose is already holy. The body is usually materialistic. Our job each and every day is, in a sense, to breathe in, is to integrate the spirit of the nose into the rest of the body. You know, it's also not a surprise that before science and medicine developed more sophisticated ways of checking for life, one of the ways to check if a person was alive is, of course, check the breathing, right? They would put a mirror, right? Maybe from a snuff box, I'm kidding. Put a mirror under the nose and see if it fogs up a little bit, if there's breath. Right? So it's life. Life is centered Kabbalistically, spiritually. Life is centered a little bit in the nose. We don't usually think about this, but Kabbalah teaches the nose is a very spiritual thing. But our job, you see, we are partners in our own creation. You know, God says, when it comes to the creation of Adam, the Torah famously says that God says, "Let us make man." God says in the collective, in the plural, "Let us make man." Who's the us? God's creating man. Who's the us? Many different explanations. One that I like to share is that God is saying, who is the us? Me and you. Who's the you? The person that we're speaking to. You are created in the image of God, but you are part of your own creation. God says, let us, me and you, create you. In other words, God's going to start off the creation, but you have to finish your own creation. You have to make yourself a mensch. I'm going to start you off. I'm going to get the process started, but I'm not going to finish the job. You're not going to be a fully formed, a fully fledged mensch by the time I'm done with it, says God. I'm going to start the process. You need to finish it. Let us make a mensch. Let us make a man It's a collective. I'm going to start it, but you need to finish it. You need to finish a job to refine yourself, which means, in this context, I'm going to give you a breath of life in your nose. You can keep it in the nose, right? You can keep it in the external part of you, and the rest of your life is totally, you know, non-menschy and materialistic. Or you can breathe in that inspiration and move it from the nose into the rest of your body so that you live a life that's a spiritual life and a holy life and a righteous life and a menschy life. That's where you come in, says God. That's where the partnership happens. Let us make man. I'm gonna give you this greatest gift of life and soul and spirituality, but you need to do the rest and integrate it yourself. God doesn't do all of it for us. God doesn't integrate it fully for us. Because if so, we wouldn't really have free choice. We would just be programmed to be perfect. And that's not what God wanted. God wanted to create, to start it off, and then for us to do all the rest of the work. And that's a work in progress. As we're going to see today in the text that we're going to study inside. So this is a major theme and work that happens on a daily basis. And the way it's framed in this text is that in the morning, the soul begins in our nose. And as the day progresses, we're supposed to move it from the nose into the rest of the body until we go to sleep at night. And then it kind of lifts back out. And then the next day, we do the process again of integrating it back in through the rest of our body. So, and we'll see also today that prayer, morning prayer, is a critical opportunity and a critical part of this movement from nose to the rest of the body, to move the soul from outside inside. You ever notice that your nose gets cold if you're cold? Right? Your nose kind of gets, my nose gets cold. My ears also. It's like external. So in a sense, that's also the message of the soul. The soul is not perfectly integrated. We have it, and obviously we're alive, but the spiritual part of it, it's not gifted to us in a way of like consciousness, you're tzaddik, you only know God and you love God, and that's the gift that you have. No, we have the soul, but it's we have that spirituality, but it's waiting. It's waiting for us to unpack it. And our job each day is to unpack it and bring it into our lives. No, I'm just saying that the fact that the nose gets cold means that it's not, you know, if our body is 98.6, maybe the nose is a little bit colder because it's outside. It's not, the nose itself, even though it's obviously attached to us in our face, but it's outside, right? So the soul is also, it's the soul being in our nose, right? God breathed it into Adam's nostrils, it's in the nose, so it's part of us, but it's, it might be a little external to who we are inside and how we live our lives. The goal is, the objective is, to unpack, right? I don't say unpack the nose, it sounds weird. But to unpack this, the soul, and bring it into our consciousness. Okay, so let's jump inside to the text. Last time, we spoke about the spiritual meaning of light and darkness. And we said that just like in the macrocosm of the universe, there is light and darkness, which means there's day and night, right? Physically speaking, like just very, very physically speaking, pragmatic. So the sun rises in the morning and the daytime hours are light, and then the sun sets and it gets dark. So there's light and dark. So just like that's true in a very physical, practical, global sense, cosmic sense, that's also true in the world that we live in, that there are light moments and there are dark moments. And he says, with regards to interpersonal relationships, light means that you know where the other person, where they're at, where they're holding with you. You know how they feel about you, you know what they think about you, and it's a very open relationship in that you know them, they know you, and everything's clear. Darkness in interpersonal relationships means that you don't know what they think about you. They tell you something, but you don't know how they really feel inside. So they might say something nice to you, and you might think that they're your friend, But in the inside, they really harbor dislike or animosity towards you, God forbid. So you might be standing, the way he phrased it, you might be standing next to a snake, next to a pit, next to something dangerous, but because it's dark, you can't see it. And then you might get bit by the snake. You might fall into the hole. So it could be dangerous, but you don't know it because it's dark. And that's why this world, he says, is called the Olam HaSheker, which is a world of falseness. It's a world of falsity because we don't know the truth and we don't see the truth. Things are blocked. There's opacity. It's opaque. You can't see behind what's going on, behind someone's eyes. You don't really know what's going on. What the person is thinking, what they're really saying, what they're really doing. You don't know it, and you really can't know it. And that creates a situation where we might be, God forbid, in a somewhat dangerous position, and we don't even know it because we're so unaware, because this world is a world of darkness and a world of falseness. Now, he says the world to come, the world of Mashiach, or the afterlife, he says, is called the Olam HaEmet, the world of truth. What does that mean? It means in that world, the light is shining, and everything is seen clearly for what it is. There's transparency, and translucency. The light is shining, and you know exactly where you stand, and where the other one stands. Everything is clear and obvious. Okay. He also said, this is the last thing that we did last time. He says that even though we exist in this world of falsity and this world of falsehood and deception and this world that is oftentimes dark in the sense that we don't know what is lurking in the heart and mind of someone else, nonetheless, he says, God can provide light for us. Even with all of the other dangers, the physical dangers, the spiritual dangers that are around us, and the darkness that we have, he says that Torah, God provides for us, Torah and mitzvot, a way of life, to provide a light to illuminate our path. So even though we may never really know what someone else is thinking, at least we can have clarity for ourselves as to the path that we should walk and live a good life ourselves. That's what he says. And he quoted a phrase, he quoted a verse, which is beautiful. Though I sit in darkness, God is a light unto me. So I may sit in the dark. I may not see. I may not know about someone else. I may never know about someone else. But nonetheless, God is a light unto me. At least God provides a light for me. And the name of God that's used in that verse is the four-letter name of God, the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, Havaya. Which, and Havai is switching around the order, that's why Kabbalistically we're allowed to say it like that and not the way that it's actually written, which we don't do. But anyway, it's the four-letter name of God that is the name of God that transcends nature. So Elohim, which is a lower-level name of God, Elohim connotes nature, Teva, nature. Remember the sandal company, Teva? Teva? Teva in Hebrew means nature. So the word Elohim, the name of God Elohim, is the same Hebrew numerical value. It shares the numerology as the Hebrew word ha-teva, which means the natural order, the nature of things. So teva, ha-teva, not the sandals, right? Nature itself is Elohim. Elohim is nature. That's the darkness. That's the concealment. Nature is, you don't see God. But Havaya, God's four-letter name, is the name of God that transcends nature, and that signifies the light that God gives to us in the form of Torah and mitzvot and allowing us to live a luminescent existence. Now, let's jump to 46. Middle of page 46, he translates this down very practically into day-to-day divine service, and this is where the nose comes in. In terms of a person's spiritual service, when one soul permeates his being and its force shines within him, it is called day. So within one's own person, when your soul is shining inside of you, when you are living a soulful existence, a soulful life, at any given moment, it's day. For you, it's day. The light is shining. Your soul is shining. It's vibrating throughout your entire being. It's informing you. It's driving you. It's guiding you on your day. It's day. But when his soul does not shine within him, it is then called night. It doesn't mean that a person doesn't have a soul. Of course a person has a soul, but it's in the nose. It's not shining throughout the being, throughout the person's body. It's not shining within them in every part of their being. So it's not day, it's night for the person. Judaism believes and Kabbalah believes that everyone has a soul. And I know you might be thinking, well, what about Hitler? I don't know about Hitler. But every, Yimach Shemo, may his name be erased. But most people, right? The average person that you're meeting, everyone, we'll just say everyone, has a soul. That doesn't mean, though, that everyone's soul is shining in them. It doesn't mean that everyone is aware of their own soul. And it doesn't mean that they live a soul-first life, that when people meet them, they see their soul. Right? Oftentimes, a person lives a materialistic life. Get up, go to work, eat something, hobbies and activities, you know, and go to bed. Where's the soul? I don't know. The soul, a soul can remain dormant for years. It can remain in a quiet state, in an exiled state, for years, for decades. Potentially even for one's whole life, God forbid. So that's considered a spiritual state of night within the person themselves. So, yeah. Soul first life, what I mean is that when you approach day-to-day life, you're doing so with your consciousness of the soul first. So you step into it not with the body first, but with the soul first. So any experience that you have, you're going to be thinking of it, you're going to be translating it into something higher. You're going to be framing it in the context of a higher experience. So if it's encountering a challenge, so the first thought is, okay, what's the lesson here? What's the message? You know, how can I transform it? When you encounter your physical needs, it's how do I elevate this experience to be a godly experience? You look for the mitzvah and everything. You look for the opportunity. You look for the beauty in yourself and others. That's living a soul-first life. You step into life, not feet first, not head first, but soul first. The body follows. The body is a necessary part of it. But the first approach is soulfully, as opposed to stepping into it with our body first, which is, I'm eating because I'm hungry. Maybe later on I'll think about, was there a higher purpose or not? I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever get there, but yeah. But I'm eating because I'm hungry. Or I see a challenge and I get despondent about it and I get broken up about it and I don't see the purpose in it. Right? I don't realize something higher and I don't get energized by the challenge. I get knocked down by the challenge. I get de-energized by the challenge. So that's body first as opposed to soul first. So one is called day and one is called night. If it's soul, if the soul permeates our being, obviously the soul is everywhere, but it's not obviously everywhere. So when it's obviously everywhere, when it's shining, when it's revealed, it's day. When it's not, it's called night. So now he translates it into tangible terms. Let's continue the next paragraph. Therefore, at night, and he means literal night, like nighttime, when the soul departs from the body, a person is in a state of complete sleep. He's now drawing the macrocosmic night, a parallel between the night in the macrocosm with the microcosm. He says, in the macrocosm, at night, now not everyone sleeps at night. Some people work at night and sleep in the day. Whatever. But be that as it may, at night, most people are sleeping, right? Most people sleep at night. So at night, it's dark. A person sleeps. Sorry, at night, it's dark. And for a person, it's also, in a sense, a state of spiritual darkness, which means that the soul is not informing the body in a conscious way. So the soul is considered to be departing from the body. Now, not altogether, obviously, but it's separating out enough that there's no conscious awareness. We're not the same when we sleep as when we're awake. So he says, therefore, a person is in a state of complete sleep. Complete sleep is a state of soul departing the body to a certain extent. That's the definition of sleep. Why is there a different state of consciousness when we sleep versus when we're awake? It has to do with the soul. How tied into the body is the soul, and how separate from the body is the soul? In the morning, God returns his soul. As it is written, they are new every morning, great is your faithfulness. Who's the they are new every morning? People. People are new every morning. Every morning, the soul, the neshama, is once again breathed into the nostrils, so to speak, and that renews a person each and every morning, and we say, Rabba Munatecha, great is your faithfulness. We say to God, thank you, we trust in you, that every morning, each morning, you will return our soul to us after this sleep experience, which is not so alive. We trust that you, we trust in your faithfulness, that you will be faithful enough, faithful to return the soul to me. Now, let's continue. So in a sense, every morning when we wake up, we're in a state of light because the soul is back and we feel alive and we're conscious. He says, no, not so fast. But since the body's life force is exceedingly coarse, a person can only embrace or might only embrace a very minute amount of the soul's radiance. Oh, so in the morning, the soul is returned to us. And we wake up, we become conscious again. So the soul is back in the body, but not so fast. Since the body might be very coarse and unrefined, the body is very materialistic, so the soul may not totally, fully shine and be integrated into the body. Only a little bit of the soul's radiance might shine inside the body. And let's continue. Now we get to the nose. This is the meaning of the phrase, quote, and it's a phrase from Isaiah, about a person who, quote, has the soul in his nostrils. Neshama ba'apav. Someone who has the soul in his nostrils, isolated in the nose. In the morning, before a person prays, the godly soul cannot radiate within his heart and body since the body is so coarse. A person wakes up in the morning and they're alive. And God has now, they're no longer in a state of pure darkness and sleep, right? Because, which is when the soul separates from the body. The soul is now back in the body, but still it's back in the body. Where? In the nose. Why? Because the body is still unrefined. You just woke up in the morning. You're not thinking about God. You're not feeling God. There's a body clumsiness. I don't mean clumsy like you're tripping, but maybe I also do. But the body, in a sense, is very coarse and very clumsy. It's very body. It's very bodily in the morning. Before we pray and become aware of God and feel God, so the godly soul, the neshama, is localized in the nose. It's not yet fully integrated, as I mentioned at length before. And let's continue. How does prayer fix things? How does prayer change things? So what is prayer? He says, tefillah, prayer, is connection. In fact, the Hebrew word tefillah means connection. He doesn't spell it out here, but I'll tell you what it says in Kabbalah. The word tefillah is not... Okay. Prayer, the English word for prayer, we typically associate with requesting something from someone else. Like, I pray, I beseech, I ask. Prayer is kind of like asking for something in English. That's what we typically associate prayer with. In Hebrew, we don't call the experience of prayer bakasha, which means request, right? Asking for something. We don't say that. Tefillah means connection. Prayer is not about asking for stuff. We also ask for things in the prayers. We also do that, but that's not what the objective is. The objective is to connect with God. And when we connect with God, we move the soul. This is where he's going with this. We move the soul from the nose into the rest of the body. It can't happen without prayer. So let's get back inside. Prayer is connection. Through prayer, look at footnote 82 that I wrote years ago. The Hebrew word for prayer is tefillah. The etymological root of tefillah is tafal, which means to paste or bind. after the parentheses. In a deeper sense, then, the service of prayer, tefillah, entails toiling during prayer to bind and connect oneself to God. We're binding ourselves to God in prayer. We're not asking.
Did you write that?
Sorry?
Did you really write that?
Yeah, I translated this.
Excellent footnote.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
4 years ago?
No. I wrote, let's see what year this came out. This came out 5768. Wow, 10 years ago. 11 years ago. I finished this right before I moved to Atlanta.
Very nice.
It was actually, I'm sorry, I finished, there's two discourses in this book. I finished the first one before I moved, and the second one was still, we were still working on it when I came to Atlanta. Anyway. Okay, yeah, so it's 10 years ago, but it's probably about 12 years. Okay. So let's get back inside to the second paragraph on top. So prayer is connection. Through prayer, one connects with God. Regarding one's status before prayer, i.e. before one connects with God through his divine service, it is written, withdraw from man who has the soul in his nostrils, for with what is he deemed worthy? Before prayer, we say, what kind of mensch is this? What kind of person is this? I haven't prayed yet. Withdraw from the man who has the soul still only localized in the nostrils. For what kind of value is in that? Oh, your soul is just in your nostrils. That God gave that to you. But what have you done about it? God put it there. Your job, our job is to move it from the nose, to inhale it into the rest of our body. It's not enough to remain in the nose. That's the default setting. We're meant to take it and run with it. That happens in prayer. Prayer is connecting, not only with God, but with the peace of God inside of us. The soul is the peace of, is the God particle, right? The God peace inside of us. So prayer means to connect with God out there and God in here, right? That I should be aware and conscious of the God that's inside of me, the peace of God that's inside of me. So that I live my day, and that's why it's so important to pray in the morning, even if it's 5 minutes. But to just take 5 minutes, however long, look, if you could take an hour, or half an hour, half an hour. But even if it's 5 minutes or 10 minutes, but that time should be totally dedicated, exclusive, no phones, no devices, no distractions, no food. Eat a little bit before that if you have to. But no distractions. It's just about me getting in touch with God and getting in touch with the neshama, my piece of God inside, the piece of God inside of me, and dedicating myself to live a soulful day. The day should be filled. I should live this day soul first. That's when I move the soul from the nose, from the nostrils, into the rest of my body. And then when I enter the day, it's a transformed day. If I start walking into the day without praying, so I'm entering the day body first, the soul is still in my nostrils, again, so to speak, right, using this imagery. So I'm very susceptible to tripping and falling and making mistakes in a spiritual sense because I haven't done that process. Even 5 minutes, but once I've integrated it, everything is transformed. Once I start walking my day, I start living my day, it's much harder to reclaim that and to get it and to breathe it back in. And it doesn't make up for all of those things that I've done without my soul integration. So it's really important to not only have this experience of soul connection and integration, which is through prayer and meditation and focusing on God and the soul, but it's important that it also happens in the beginning of the day so that the rest of the day follows in a healthy fashion. So, and he's quoting, again, this verse from Isaiah that says almost like, stay away from someone whose soul is still in their nostrils. Because what kind of person is that? It's not meant to be in a derogatory, although it kind of sounds like that. But I mean, for us, we're not meant to be like judging people. Like, oh, are you a nostril soul person? I don't want to talk to you. Like, yeah, unfriend me on Facebook. It's not, okay. But it's bringing out the context that there are people whose souls might still be stuck in the nostrils. And they didn't integrate it yet because they didn't pray. They didn't have that connection experience. Our sages comment, and he takes it a step further. Listen to this. Our sages commented on this verse, do not read the word as bameh, with what is he worthy, but rather as bama, which is a platform. What does that mean? Okay, he's going to explain. It's great because Hebrew, there's so many layers in Hebrew. It's so rich. Hebrew is like, it's a language of mystery and intrigue and just mystique. I mentioned before about neshama and neshima, soul and breath. It's like a great discovery. Oh my gosh, we can get centered through our breath. Yeah, look at the Hebrew words. Neshama and neshima, it's the same Hebrew letters. Nun, shin, mem, hey. The vowelization is different. By the way, in Hebrew, you don't have to write. You don't even need to use letters for the vowels. Just put dots. So the consonants are what's important. I know I just said this as a by the way, but that's actually a major point. In Hebrew, let me explain. In Hebrew, you don't typically have letters that are vowels. You don't have vowel letters. The vowels are done through what we call the nekudot, which are dots under or above the letters. Or between the letters, and they signify how to read it. So, for example, in Hebrew, you would write, let's say, the word Moshe, Moses, right? Moshe is written Mem, Shin, and He. Moshe. Okay? Moshe, the way it's written in Hebrew, without any vowelization, like if you open up a Torah school and you see the letters Mem, Shin, He, it could be Moshe, it could be Maseh, which means a package. It can mean miseh, which means from my animal. It says a goat, and the mem prefix means from. So from my animal, right? What else? How else could you pronounce it? You could pronounce it any number of ways, and the way you pronounce it, it's a different word. But the fact that they all share the same consonants means that there's a connection. It's not surprising, or se means sheep. Right? It's not surprising that Moses is the one who chased after the sheep and carried it when the sheep escaped. Right? So there's a connection there also conceptually. Neshima, neshama share the same basic Hebrew letters. Breath and soul, the breath through the nose and the soul, it's connected. And here he says the same thing with the Hebrew letters bet, mem, and hey. You could read it as, and the way it's written in Scripture is, although there are no vowels in Scripture, but that's our tradition, is that's how it's supposed to be read, is bameh, which means with what. Meh means what, or ma means what, like ma, nishana, right? Ma, what, or why, whatever. Bameh means with what is this person worthy? If they only have the soul and their nose, if they haven't integrated it, what's the value? Where's the spiritual integrity over there? Or where's the value? We don't see that spirituality within the person. But he says it's also related to the Hebrew word bama. Bama, not bameh, bama, which means an elevated platform. If you have a stage, at a concert, a platform, anything that's a structure that's high, is called a bama. In fact, in ancient times, it was also used to refer to as an altar, to refer to an altar. If you had, a private issue altar, a home version, at a certain point, Jewish law says, once there's a temple in Jerusalem, you can't bring an offering in your backyard, in your own private altar to God. It has to be in the temple. But for there were times in Jewish history when there wasn't a temple yet, where you could bring your own offerings in your backyard on your own bama platform. So it wasn't an altar, but it was your own platform. And then at a certain point, the Torah talks about when you're allowed to, when you're not allowed to. But anyway, the word bama means a platform. What that evokes, what that evokes conceptually is a person who looks at themselves as an elevated platform, right? As a, look at me. I'm me, I'm Ari, look how great I am, and look at this, and look at that. So an elevated, a bama person, it's like, not that they're like on the stage, it's not literally the stage, but it's about more of being, someone that takes themselves very seriously, and they lift themselves up, and they say, look at me, look at who I am. So let's and the two are connected. When the soul is only in your nose, and you haven't integrated your spiritual soul, then typically you're like, look at me. You're the bama. You're the rising platform type of person. So let's jump into it. The verse is thus, so we're now in the third paragraph on 48. The verse is thus interpreted as follows. Withdraw from man. Separate yourself from a person whose soul lies only in his nostrils, one whose soul has yet to permeate his entire body, for he is deemed a bama, a platform. A platform, next paragraph, is something that is physically high, something that appears as a separate entity. Similarly, one who has not yet prayed is a being that is, I guess, seemingly independent and separate from God until he prays, which is the idea of connection when he connects with godliness. So here, maybe a little bit different than the way I just explained it, but a bama platform is its own entity. Before we pray, so again, our spirituality, our soul, we woke up in the morning, so God definitely gave us back our soul, but it's still stuck in the nose, right? It hasn't yet permeated. So we feel ourselves as separate from God. We feel ourselves as I'm me and God is God, and we haven't yet connected. We haven't yet connected through prayer. So a person is their own separate, you know, high space, if you will, or high structure, until prayer. And through prayer, here we go. Oh, no, no. So this adds a new idea. Until he prays, which is the idea of connection when he connects with godliness. When we pray, we connect with God. We connect with our soul, and it moves it from the nostrils to the rest of our body, to our whole being, and it brings us down from platform to connected being with God. So it's very simple. Three states of being. When we sleep, the soul is somewhat separated from the body, which is why we're not conscious. Or we're in a sleep state, dreamlike state. So when we sleep, the soul is, let's say, it's not literally, but figuratively, outside the body. When we wake up, we're given the soul back. So we once again become conscious. We become aware of our surroundings and aware of self. But the spirituality of the soul is still not yet integrated. We haven't yet connected with it. Even though we have it, we haven't connected with it. We haven't done the work to really think about it and feel it. So that state, that middle state, we have the soul, but we don't really connect with it yet. We haven't really connected with it yet. That's the soul nostril state. That's when the soul is still in the nostrils. When we pray, that brings the soul into our entire being. 2nd to last paragraph in 48, the last line, he introduces a new point. And through prayer, one transforms physical objects into conduits for godliness. What does that mean? It means when a person prays and they connect with God and they connect with the spiritual peace of God inside of themselves, him or herself, right? When we connect with God and when we connect with our true spiritual essence, through prayer, because prayer is connection, it's not asking God for stuff, it's literally becoming aware and mindful of who I am and who God is and what purpose is. When I do that through prayer, now I can transform the physical objects that I come in contact with into conduits for godliness after prayer. When I leave prayer and I walk into the world, and now I'm walking into the world, as I mentioned before, soul first, I can now transform everywhere I walk. All the things that I touch can be transformed, like an alchemist, from, what is it, lead or anything, into gold. Everything that I touch is gold, spiritual gold. Because whatever I encounter, whether it's something good, I make it godly. Whether it's something mundane, I make it divine. Whether it's something challenging, I make it purposeful and meaningful. Whatever I touch, wherever I walk, whatever I encounter, whoever I meet, whatever I do, becomes transformed. There's a positive experience, there's a godly experience in the world around me when I walk into it coming from the connection that happened in prayer. So when I wake up in the morning, my soul's in my nostrils. Then I need to pray. Prayer is connection. By the way, prayer is an art form. It's not simply reading words on a page. Prayer means study and meditation. It can be done in a short amount of time because it really is about centering and about just becoming aware of what's true and what's real and who I am and who God is. And the longer that is, the more impactful it is, and the longer it lasts within us throughout the day. But even 5 minutes can center us. So we wake up in the morning and we're alive, and we're aware that we're alive, but we're not spiritually, you know, super. We're not super aware of our spirituality. Prayer is the time when we focus: who am I? What am I? Why am I? Who is God? Why is God? Where is God? Right? All of these things. I become aware of my purpose, aware of who I am. And then I walk out into the world, and now I can transform physical objects into conduits for godliness. Everything that I touch is godly. I see godliness in everything. I see that God is everywhere, and I see that I am meant to somehow transform this situation. Let's continue. Last paragraph on 48. Now, in order for... does this make sense so far? Yes? Okay. Now, in order for there to be this deep internal connection between God and man, we're talking here now about a person who feels God inside of them, feels their soul. It's not just in the nose, it's in their being. How does that happen? In order for there to be this deep internal connection between God and man, to the extent that one even elicits godliness within all physical matters, it's not only that you feel God, but wherever you walk, you are imparting a feeling of God in that experience. You meet someone, they feel transformed because they met you. You eat something, the food is transformed. You experience a challenge, the challenge is transformed. Wherever you walk, you're changing the world around you. How does that happen? So there must first be, before that can happen, there must first be a more general external connection. Following the pattern that we've been saying throughout this discourse, that in order to get something deep, you have to set it up with something a little less deep. So if you really want to integrate godliness inside of you, your godliness inside of you, your soul, if you really want to connect with God to the point that you're also going to impart godliness in the world around you as you walk through your day and through your life, you have to begin with a basic connection. And here's the kicker. This is why our sages say that only with a sense of earnestness may one begin to pray. If you want your prayer to be deep and meaningful, if you want those 5 minutes to be transformative for you and for the rest of your day, if you want to really take your soul from your nose into the rest of your being, if that's the objective, if that's the goal, you can't just jump into it. 0 to 60. Maybe the Tesla with rocket boosters can pull that off. But a human being coming at it cold, you just woke up in the morning, or you recently woke up in the morning, and your soul is in your nose, and now you want to feel God and feel your soul, how do you do that? You have to begin with what the Talmud calls, a sense of earnestness. It's hard to translate, but we're going to read it, and then we're going to explain it, and then we'll close it out. It's only with a sense of earnestness that one may begin to pray, which Rashi explains is referring to the quality of surrender and humility. For this establishes the initial general connection between man and God. You cannot expect to feel God inside, to feel your soul inside, so that your day is transformed. You cannot expect to feel it without doing a little bit of preparation. And what's the preparation, he says? Surrender and humility. Surrender and humility means I say to myself before I pray, before those 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever it is, before I start praying, I say I'm about to enter into an experience that is all about connection with God. I am letting go of myself, and now I'm allowing myself to connect with God. If I don't give up myself, I won't be able to connect with God. As long as I'm holding on to my platform, right? Metaphorically, what we said before. As long as I'm holding on to my bama, my elevation, who I am, my identity, I am this, I am that, I know this, I know that. As long as I'm holding on to self, it's going to be hard to connect with God and with the soul that's in my nose because I'm holding on to my body. Before I begin to pray, I have to let go of my body. I have to surrender the physical part of who I am. And when I surrender, then I can now connect. So really, he says, effective prayer is comprised of 2 steps. Number 1, letting go. And number two, taking in. Letting go of ego, of material self, of platform self, of body self. Letting go of lower self, step one. And then step two is, now I can understand and meditate on and accept and love and feel God and the soul. By the way, the prayer, the siddur that we have, the prayer book, the prayers are designed to get us thinking and to get us feeling. We talk about how God creates everything, every blade of grass, every tree, every mountain, every ocean, right? Everything is created by God. We begin thinking about it. All the angels, we talk about the angels, how the angels are created from God. The prayers are designed in various steps, step by step, four steps in the siddur. One day we'll have a course in which we break down all the prayers and we illuminate the meditations within the prayer so that prayer, we can connect with it in a meaningful way. But just know that the siddur, the prayer, is not just a bunch of words on a page, but it's really designed to get us to connect with God. But before we do that, he says, you cannot connect with God, cannot integrate with God in a deep way, have a deep internal connection, without a basic connection first. And the basic connection, he says, is really about divesting oneself, surrendering, divesting oneself of one's being stuck in their own materialistic state. So it's surrender and humility. It's a person saying, I'm letting myself be in a relationship with God. I'm allowing myself to let go and to embrace God. Then the deeper connection can happen. This follows the pattern that we've been saying throughout this discourse, that first you need an external connection, and then you need the deeper connection. So let's close it out for today. So what do we say? We talked about the nose, and how spiritual the nose is, how it's the first point of contact between God's soul, God's breath of life, soul of life, and the human being. The first point of contact is the nose. We spoke about how the nose, how scent, is the most spiritual of all the senses. It's the one that's the least corrupted by materialism. We don't typically run after, you know, they don't have shops. Maybe they do. They don't have scent shops. Maybe they do. Is that a thing? Like a store, like a place that's designed to tantalize just the nose. I don't know that exists.
Candy.
Oh, the candle shops. Yeah,
essential oils.
Oh, yeah. Well, there goes that theory. Fine, there are scent. Yeah, perfumes. What am I saying? Yeah, of course there are.
What am I saying?
What kind of stuff is this? Anyway, yeah. Okay, fine. So, but of all the senses, Kabbalah still maintains, maybe Kabbalah existed before the cosmetic counters in Macy's. I don't know. Maybe, you know, it's, maybe things would change if they only knew what was going on today at Nordstrom. Nonetheless, the nose and scent is considered to be the most spiritual and the least corrupted by materialism, which is why we say the prayer on the spices and the Havdalah and other things that we spoke about. We also mention that at night, the soul is somewhat separate from us. In the morning, it's connected, but not fully integrated. So it remains in the nose. And our job is to move it from the state of suspension, if you will, into a state of integration. Move it from the nose into the rest of the body. We spoke about the correlation between neshima and neshama, and the meaning of bama, platform. And we also spoke about how prayer is the key component to integrating our spirituality into us, which then transforms our day and the world around us. But we can't just expect to connect in prayer without first a preparation for prayer. And that preparation is surrender and humility, which is not the connection itself, but it paves the way for a deep and meaningful connection. Thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and Cosmetics.